The New Yorker is known for its incisive reporting on world and national events, but the magazine's cover art has sometimes incited more controversy than what's between the covers, especially since Françoise Mouly took over as art editor 19 years ago. But if you've been outraged by any of the published covers, Ms. Mouly has now put together a collection called Blown Covers, New Yorker Covers You Were Never Meant to See, in which she explains the process by which the magazine's cover art gets chosen and why one image makes it while another doesn't. It's published by Abrams, and I'm very pleased it has brought Françoise Mouly back to our show today. Hi, Françoise.
Hi, Lenny. I'm so happy to be here and with you.
Why did you feel there was a need to show the world the cover ideas that didn't get published?
Because the process that the artist goes through as they're looking for images is fascinating. I think I have the best job in the world, and I'm really privileged to be working with some of the greatest cartoonists and artists. And ultimately, my job is being in touch on a daily basis with all those great humorists and artists, and then trying to make my boss laugh, which I wish everybody had that.
Is that part of the deal? You bring it to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, and if he laughs, then
if he laughs, it's actually like, 98% of the way there. It's not, as there are images that can be very moving and will, of course, not make him laugh. But certainly, in terms of finding an image that is an encapsulation of a thought, of an idea, humor is great because it cuts through a lot of nonverbal, complex issues.
And before we get going any further, alert our listeners to the fact that we have a slideshow which shows some of the covers that we're talking about during this segment at WNYC.org on our show page at the Leonard LoPage Show. Are there any of the covers that didn't make it that you really wish could have been used?
Well, all of them. The reason I was gathering all this is because I have the enviable position of being able to tell the artist, send me everything, don't edit yourself, don't worry about embarrassing yourself. With Anita Kuntz, an artist that we work with, who's in Canada, I said, think of me as your priest.
you have a lot of priest covers, which we'll get to later.
Yes. But what I mean by that is that they can try to make me laugh, but they can also try to provoke a response and to encapsulate an idea. And I don't have to worry about whether it's publishable or not, because when I show it to David Remnick, then I know good taste will prevail.
Well, didn't you study to be an architect in France?
Yeah, I did.
That doesn't sound like a good preparation for choosing the cover art and some of the other art in The New Yorker.
Oh, quite the contrary. I would say that, I would recommend for everybody to study to be an architect, because it's good schooling and good preparation. It does force you to think about form and function and how they go together, because a building shouldn't just be like a sculpture in its form. Neither should it be strictly functional. But it's also not something I would recommend to many people, because it's incredibly frustrating. In school, you're being given an assignment and design a building, design a city, even as an 18-year-old in art school. But the reality of it is far more dire. Whereas when I discovered, I met Art Spiegelman. First I read his work, and then I met him. And first I fell in love with his work, and then I fell in love with him.
And you co-published Raw?
Yes. And at the time, it was because of that personal discovery of mine of oh my God, a world on papers. This is the ability for an artist to create something.
Well, Raw is very cutting edge, anti-establishment stuff. Very different sensibility from The New Yorker when you were doing those things. Is it the reason that Tina Brown brought you on board, wanting to get some of that harder edge? Because The New Yorker was kind of staid at the time that she took over.
Well, the New Yorker has a long history. So it started in 1925, and it had gone through only four editors before Tina was brought in 1992. And the mandate that she was given was to revive the magazines that had maybe fossilized itself in, sure, it was a bastion of excellence in journalism and fiction and poetry, but the cover art had been decided by William Shawn, and his favorite artist was Saul Steinberg. And, of course, he is one of the best idea picture artists of the world. But it didn't have any connection to anything that was happening around it. So
well,
Tina,
well, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Tina knew which artist she wanted to bring in. And one of she wanted to bring in Avedon, who became the first photographer for The New Yorker. Ed Sorrell, who did some wonderful covers. And she wanted to bring in Art Spiegelman because she knew Mouse. And when she asked Art to do a cover, he proposed something for Valentine's Day that had to do with what was going on in Crown Heights at the time. And he drew a Hasid case. A black woman. And there was huge dissension from everybody, old school New Yorker, about even addressing that topic, let alone doing such an explosive picture. And it made everybody talk about the New Yorker. It was a buzz, which was something that Tina was looking for. And then she realized she wanted more of that.
And that covers on our slideshow at WNYC.org. But and Art had just won a Pulitzer at the time, so Tina at least had a good excuse. For using him to do that. You weren't yet on board. When she offered you the job, were you surprised?
I totally unexpected, because she had access to all the great art directors in the city at the time, and I wasn't in the running as far as I was concerned. But I think she looked at the kind of art that was in Raw magazine, and she realized that she shouldn't do what was expected, and she shouldn't continue in that tradition, that the New Yorker was strong enough to actually go back. She herself was interested in the Harold Ross New Yorker, which started as a humor magazine. And Art did a number of other controversial covers, and then I brought in the artists from Raw, such as Charles Burns, Richard McGuire, Matotti, European artist, and worked with children's book artists. Anybody who was a narrative artist, somebody who had something to say.
Now, we should point out that Saul Steinberg, when he did some of his covers, they became classics, like the wonderful one, View of the World from 9th Avenue, which shows the world very much from the Manhattan-centric point of view of New Yorkers, and became a classic, wound up becoming poster. Some of those covers were brilliant, too, but they weren't edgy, and I just wonder whether that matters. Some magazines will tell you that sales go up depending on the cover or down. Do the covers affect sales of The New Yorker?
Well, one of the wonderful things about The New Yorker is that the answer is no, it doesn't, because it's primarily a magazine that is in connection with its reader by subscription. So the overwhelming percentage of issues that get to people's houses is through the mail, and it doesn't matter what's on the cover. So it's a fait accompli by the time. But it is a way of connecting with new readers and finding maybe a younger audience, certainly at the time.
Now, when Hasidic Kiss created that big stir, was Tina pleased with the reaction?
She loved having people talk about the images. And I think that is something that really felt congenial to Art and to me, that I think that the artists should be at the center of a dialogue. When they are provocative issues, I think images are a really good catalytic point to make you talk.
Now, you came in and you introduced new artists and some new ideas, but did the basic process of how a cover was chosen remain the same?
Well, when I first came in, the art editor that preceded me just said, like, oh, you make a pile of things, and then you go and show it to the editor, and then if they like it, you put it on the left, and if they don't like it, you put it on the right. That was his editing process. Mine became a little bit more systematized than that. I'm in a constant dialogue with a number of artists whose work I admire, and I'm trying to have the right image at the right time, because that's something that I learned from Tina Brown, that timing is essential.
Because the New Yorker is a weekly magazine, so you don't want to look like you're putting out a magazine that's 3 weeks old or 2 years old.
Well, and also because in terms of like entering into that discussion, you don't want to talk about last week's news. And in a way, you want to take a record of the time. And what I had to do, I knew nothing about the New Yorker when I got that call from Tina. I mean, I didn't grow up with it. I grew up in France. So I actually had to go to the library and look at the images. And I didn't look so much at the images from the 80s, 70s, because those were very decorative and artistic, but I looked at the images from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and those are narrative storytelling images by Charles Adams, for example, or by Mary Petty or Helen Hawkinson, actually the early New Yorker, as a lot of women artists, which give a really nuanced portrait of what sophisticated urban New Yorkers were going through at the time, not just what they looked like or what they were wearing, but their prejudices and their loves and their attitudes. And then I realized that's what I can do, is that I can actually solicit artists to take snapshots of where we're at.
So since this is very much of the moment, have you agreed to do a cover and then realize at the last minute you wanted to do something else?
Oh, it happens all the time because we work with two different kinds, broadly, two different kind of schedule, an evergreen kind of images that are prepared in advance. So right now I'm talking to artists about, like, how about June weddings, how about summer, how about, reading and fiction on the beach and so on. So those can be prepared in advance. And then when there is something in the news where we have something to say, when there's a good idea that comes, because that's one of the privileges. Last year, for example, I remember I learned of Steve Jobs' death, and I got in touch with Remnick, and I said, like, do you want us to try to do something? And he said, well, it's Wednesday. You know, we already have a cover at the printer. It would have to be pretty darn good. Otherwise, we could sit that one out because we don't have to do the news of the week. Turns out that Barry Blitz sent a sketch of Steve Jobs at the gates of heaven. So did 20 other artists who actually sent sketches right away, because when some big news event happens, the artists know we're going to be looking for the best possible images. So before I even have a chance to pick up the phone, they're sending me all those sketches. And once a sketch was approved by Barry, it took him, I think, like less than 24 hours before he did a finish, and then we sent that to the printer.
And then you had to pull the other cover off.
That happens all the time. So rejection is by far, like, having to call up this artist, oh, sorry, it doesn't run. I didn't run. And it can run later or it can run next year. Like, we've run some covers this year that I've had in the bank for, we ran a cover in December that had had it in the bank for 12 years.
On the other hand, there is the cover by Art that was related to the Amadou Diallo shooting, which depicted a cop at a Coney Island shooting gallery. And that was very much of the moment. How did the police department respond to that one?
Oh, that was that's one of the images I'm the most proud of, because this was a shooting that had happened. It had been in the news, but it was actually disappearing from the news cycle, even though people were unhappy with Giuliani's lack of response and lack of investigation. It's true that we had little information, but there was a gut feeling that needed to be captured. But it's so difficult that I didn't even mention it to the artist until one night, like, I was, because Art is my husband, so, you know, there's discussions of work that take place in the bedroom.
And what about discussions of nepotism? Did they ever come up?
Well, it's built in with a job definition, but, you know, we do the best in the sense that, like, if Art has an idea that is not the best of everything that I receive, then I will have to put up with the disappointment, and then I won't be able to come home and forget about it. So, yes, it cuts both ways. It also makes it more difficult to reject anything from him.
You had the reaction to the president's coming out in support of gay marriage.
Yeah.
So, was that a last-minute change again? Absolutely.
We had an image that I already told the artist that this image was at the printer. It literally was, and we'll run it soon, so I don't even want to talk about it. But at the last minute, I got a call again on a Wednesday from David Remnick, who was in Washington, about the fact that Obama was coming out in support of gay marriage. And same thing, is that we have very little time, but we'll only do something if we have something worth doing. And we looked at the because it's so many diverse artists sending things, we had some that were more jokey and funny, like Barry Blitz sent something about Joe Biden at a wedding of two men, and both the two men and Obama have a hand on their forehead as Biden is about to raise his glass and make a toast. So there were some, but when I talked to Remnick about this, for example, here, he was saying, like, no, we want to find an image that's going to let us remember this moment in 6 months from now, not just that joke of the day, but something that has lasting value.
My guest is Françoise Mouly. She's put together a book, a large format book, a lot of color, called Blown Covers, New Yorker Covers You Were Never Meant to See. And the book includes some of the book, the covers that you have seen and the process that got them to look the way they did. Also, some that never made it, and we'll get into why some of them never got published. In some cases, it's quite obvious, Françoise. You probably thought that people would come and bomb the offices of The New Yorker if a couple of those things were published. But you've been mentioning Barry Blitt. Now he has a kind of a political cartoon style. He used to do the illustrations for Frank Rich's op-ed pieces when Frank Rich was still at the New York Times. And he's done some of the more controversial ones along with Art Spiegelman. But Art also did, you mentioned there are some that are rather, that are not meant to be funny or cut politically. Art did probably one of the most memorable ones, the Black and White Towers, right after 9/11, one of the most beautiful covers The New Yorker ever ran, and one that people told me actually brought tears to their eyes.
Yes, this is something that we did together, Art and I, that was born exactly of our experience at that moment, since we rushed down to get our daughter when we saw a plane go into a tower. And I ended up having to look for an image, which at the time felt very obscene, frankly, to have to be going to work and look for an image rather than stay home with my kids and hug them. And it came from, like, not being able to find an image and then thinking, well, in that case, there was a suggestion from David Remnick and from other people about running a photo, because that would break the long tradition of not having run photos. But it seemed like a cheap way out and an admission of defeat. And the true admission of defeat was to run a black cover. And Art was working on another image, which was very brightly colored, and it was shrouded towers against a bright blue sky. But I did say to him that image wasn't going to work for the cover, but that I was just going to do a black cover. And that's when he suggested to do the silhouette of the towers, which I rendered and then became that image.
Black on black.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the artists in the book, Barry Blitt, who you've mentioned a number of times, has the most covers by far, something like 68 or so?
Yes, but it's not the most covers that were ever done by an artist at the magazine, because in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, an artist like Arthur Goetz, for example, did virtually like a cover a month, so he has 200 or 300 covers. But Barry is a person that I will talk to almost every time when there is something that's either in the top of the news or at the bottom of the news, because he's really good at the bottom of the news also. You know, for example, one of the memorable cover for me by Barry is Ahmadinejad on the toilet, which of course is not something that The New Yorker is looking for all the time, to do a world leader sitting on the on the toilet, but at the time was relevant because 3 months before there had been a senator who had been caught in an airport bathroom, and since he was a Republican who had violently denounced gays, it was interesting that he was caught soliciting an undercover agent in the bathroom. And just that week in September, Ahmadinejad had come. The papers were full about Iran's stance, nuclear weapon, and so on, but he gave a speech at Columbia University, which made it a local thing for us, which is great because we're always trying to focus things from a New York-centric point of view, in which he said that there were no homosexuals in this country. So this image by Barry Blitz showing Ahmadinejad reading the newspaper on the toilet was a really good image in denouncing hypocrisy of politicians.
Now, perhaps his most controversial cover was The Politics of Fear, also known as the White House Fist Bump, in which Barack and Michelle Obama pictured as terrorists. It was obviously a commentary on some of the more outrageous claims being made about the president. So were you surprised that readers were so unhappy about it? Were you prepared for that reaction?
No, we weren't prepared. No, we were prepared for it getting a reaction because the purpose of doing the image, I was talking to various artists throughout the spring of 2008 about all of the unspoken part of the campaigns on all parts, but there were remarks about Obama which said that he wasn't electable coming from, you know, and what does that mean? And there was, you know, talk about the gap between what people said, who they said they would vote for, the Bradley effect, and who they actually would vote for. So between people's intention and their maybe secret prejudices. So I was asking artists to try to come up with an image that showed things that were unspeakable. And that's what happened. I was on the phone with Barry Blitt, and he said, oh, I was thinking of doing Barack Obama with his wife, with Michelle Obama, in the White House, but shows them the way pundits such as Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter and whatever see them, meaning like him as a Muslim and her as a terrorist.
And in the original drawing, which you show us, they are looking through the window.
Well,
but
yes.
You got rid of them.
In the original drawings, that was Barry's idea, is to represent Rush Limbaugh's worst fear, you know, to give body to it, since that's what he's denouncing in words. And then when I looked at the image, I said, well, but that's actually assigning this kind of like caricature to only two or three people, but the innuendos are all over CBS News, ABC, and so on. So might as well make it more of a comment about our own unspoken innuendos and our own fears. And that, I think, is really interesting because when we were denounced by everybody saying, I get it, I understand. But condescendingly, they also said, I am only upset about what other people, we will not be able to have my enlightened view of this image. So,
by the way, that image is also on our slideshow. The covers we've discussed, controversial as some of them were, did get published. But so what do you have to do to do one that can't be published?
Well, again, we...
Is anything too controversial, too political, too risque?
Well, it depends on the time and on the way the image is presented. Sometimes there are many images that can't get published because the logistics work against us. You know, I ask artists to send things, again, without worrying about whether it's publishable or not, but sometimes, like, we have a double issue out and we can't get to it until 2 weeks later, and by then it's not, it's too late.
Well, one of Barry Blitz's submissions was a Father's Day scene showing a grinning priest with three unhappy-looking little boys. Since it was based on something that regularly was discussed in newspapers, was it rejected because it was making light of a very serious situation?
Well, I think it's a Father's Day image. He presented it with a father holding a Father's Day card, so the timing of it was really good for me in terms of being within that structure of like timeless images. But what this actually put into evidence is not so much the abuse that priests have committed as much as the hypocrisy of the church, which was not investigating. So that's what was in the newspaper at the time, is the sweeping under the rug. And that's a good target. And I think that had it been published, it would have been understood that way, because it's an innocent picture. For example, Barry Blatt also did Tiger Woods, and he's standing there with his golf club, and he's trying to figure out which hole he's going to put the ball in. Now, it's a very clean picture, because there's nothing compared to the covers of the tabloids that showed him with like any of the 126 women that he had been identified having liaisons with. It's actually like, you know, the Tiger Woods that had been endorsing all of those products, looking very seriously. But it's what you read into it. It's how you phrase and decode the image that forces you, implicates you, because as a reader, in all those images, they're not so didactic to tell you what to think, but they actually make you think about what they represent. And it's when you're implicated and then you realize that you are saying to yourself, like you're decoding those images, that you start being shocked.
Do you feel that you're sometimes setting the tone for what's inside the magazine?
It happens sometimes intentionally, because we do special issues. So, for example, right now we are going to the printer with an issue that's a fiction issue, and it has a special theme. So next week's issue will be the science fiction issue, and the cover reflects that. And the cover explains that very specifically. So sometimes it is part of the assignment, because The New Yorker has so many different incarnations that sometimes I'm asked to use a cover to actually define what's inside. Every once in a while, we'll do a cover that's actually a representation of a big article that is inside. And in a way, the cover by Barry Blitt of the fist bump was paired with an article inside about Obama. So it's part of the beauty of the magazines that the artists and the writers come and can coexist.
Now, another one that didn't make it in is about Diet Coke and Mentos. And I didn't understand that.
You didn't.
No, what was that referring to?
Does
the story have to be really well known to make it?
Well, that's exactly why we didn't publish it, because anybody who has spent countless hours, doesn't include me, Barry Blitt, like the fact that I actually, you know, grew up outside of the culture, and that some of those references don't make sense to me, and that I don't spend endless hours like playing videos on YouTube or whatever, and that the artists have to explain something to me, is not a detriment, but it's actually useful, because it forces them to really make their idea clear. This was two men dressed as Arabs in Arab garb, and in the airplane, making sure that the stewardess had passed, one of them was handing a tube of Mentos to the other one, who had a Diet Coke on this little table. Now, there were so many people who had been aware of a fad, that was a YouTube fad, of if you put Mentos in Diet Coke, it turns out that the nuclear sites on the candy create a geyser and an explosion. They thought this was hilarious, but we found out because that this wasn't a universal reference point, so we actually stayed away from publishing it.
Now, one of the most shocking ones, which never made it to the cover, is a Barry Blitt picture that you have put on the cover of this book.
I'm glad you asked about it, because this is an image, I am blessed with a process that is so direct. So many art directors complain about the fact that they have to defend their images to committees of people, and then they have to over-explain, and everything dies through the explanation. I am blessed because I can just show an image to one person, to my editor, and if he likes it, it goes, and that's great. And I had that process with this image that shows the Pope on top of a Marilyn Monroe, on top of a grill, Subway grill, and his long skirts are lifted a la Marilyn Monroe by the air below. So it shows you the underside of the Catholic Church. And it also was around the time of not just the abuse, but the abuse being revealed, and the lack of of dealing with it that had been at the higher levels of the church. But when I showed that image to David, he asked me, because he was traveling, to show it to other people. And that's when I saw the word people talk themselves out of a good joke.
Francoise Mouly will be moderating a panel of cartoonists, including Roz Chast, Art Spiegelman, and Barry Blitt, tonight at the 92nd Street Y. That's at 8:15. And then she'll be speaking and signing books tomorrow at 7:30 at Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn on Fulton Street. The book we've been talking about is Blown Covers, New Yorker Covers You Were Never Meant to See. It's published by Harry Abrams. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you, Lanny.